You're listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast. Join us for weekly discussions diving into all the particulars of communication, voice, swallow, and cognition with tangible applications to the world of medical speech and language pathology. Additional resources that accompany this discussion and the discussion guide are in specially curated show notes on speechuncensored.com. Rebecca Brown joins me this week to chat about building relationships in the Insular Neonatal Intensive Care Unit. Rebecca offers lessons learned the hard way, so you don't have to, and insight into navigating professional relationships. She also dives into the differences between infant-driven feeding and volume-dependent feeding. I'm so pleased to have Rebecca on the podcast because I love her passion for this field and how she lifts up other SLPs. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm your host, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Without further ado, let's hear from Rebecca. How are you doing, Rebecca?
I'm doing great. I'm so glad to be here with you, Leanne. Love it.
I'm so glad. I'm like really excited that I have you all to myself because we recorded two episodes previously with Michelle Dagon and Jordan Hazelwood. And those were kind of like joint interviews and everything. And now I get to have you on to talk about your passion of the NICU.
Yes, I'm really excited. Today we're going to be talking about just navigating complex relationships with different staff in the neonatal intensive care unit. I am a speech language pathologist practicing in a level 3 NICU. I'm a certified neonatal therapist. I also teach a couple courses at local universities, and I'm pursuing my PhD in health sciences with a neuro rehab concentration. I work with adults as well, but a lot of my interest does lie in the neonatal intensive care unit. And I have to be completely honest, I didn't really even know what speech pathologists did in the NICU when I graduated with my master's degree several years ago. And I kind of fell into this profession because I went to work at a teaching hospital. And it was a requirement for me to get trained in the NICU to work there. And I said, well, I don't know what that is, but you know, I'm really excited like to get that opportunity. Sounds cool. Let's do it. And I kind of had a rough go of it, to be completely honest, at the first place that I worked, because I didn't know that these difficult relationships existed necessarily between therapy and nursing and neonatologists. I didn't have a full grasp on that. And I think that was a great learning experience for me for what to do and not to do when I came into a new role that I'm in now, more local to where I grew up. And I feel like I've been able to better establish good relationships with the staff at my current place of employment because of some of the hard lessons that I learned early on. So I do want to touch a little bit on that. And I first have to set up why those awkward relationships sometimes exist. But for people who don't know, speech language pathologists work in the neonatal intensive care unit, and they often work alongside PT or OT, and cohesively we are termed like together neonatal therapists. And we often target like positioning, a term called neuroprotection, which is just simply protecting the infant's developing brain, because when babies are born early, they don't have a fully developed brain, which is probably something even our listeners who have little background in NICU know. And so their brain continues to develop out of utero instead of inside the utero. So we promote positive behaviors that stimulate the brain's growth in a way that is not going to map negative experiences into their brain. And so neuroprotection and preventative care is a lot of what neonatal therapists do in the NICU. Now, ASHA has a position statement on what they want speech language pathologists to really know in order to be proficient in the NICU. NANT has, National Association of Neonatal Therapists, NANT, has a more comprehensive checklist, and we use that for the development of our competencies in our unit. I think we will put a link to the NANT in the show notes, but they have a really good resource. If you are a speech language pathologist interested in working in the NICU and you kind of want to know what you might need to know more of and be able to do, they have great resources on that. I was going to go over a couple things: understanding normal embryology, perinatal, postnatal infant development, atypical infant development. This is all per ASHA, by the way. Understanding family-centered practices, including the impact of the NICU experience on family dynamics and function, information about family systems, parent-infant interactions, parent empowerment, and meaningful professional alliances. So family-centered care is really what you want to achieve in your NICU, because that is what the goal is for our infants who are born term and who get to go home with the families right away, right? And when the infant is removed from the family because they're born early, that family dynamic changes because they're, you know, separated when typically they'd be like right there with the mom and dad at birth. And so we really want to achieve the family-centered care dynamic in our unit as much as we can. Obviously, we can't do it as well as we could if they hadn't have been removed because they needed, you know, ongoing higher level of care. But we try to achieve that through promotion of parents being at the bedside as much as they can, obtaining information on their babies, like attending interdisciplinary rounds, being a part of the first bath, lots of skin to skin. Our neonatologist is really an advocate of that, even if the babies are smaller. As soon as they're stable to be able to do all of those things, we promote that. And just involving them in all of the experiences from day one is how we try to establish the family-centered care mindset, because that dynamic, you know, obviously changes when the infant has to admit to the NICU instead of being able to stay in the room with mom and dad and or go home immediately. So understanding that practice is really important.
I can imagine how challenging it might be for parents who have a premature infant born, and then suddenly, you know, there's like a whole team of people involved in caring for them, and they were expecting to be the ones caring for that infant. And now they're like, oh, do I not know how to care for this baby of mine? Like, I need to be trained. I need to be taught. How do you go about looping the family in on what is neuroprotection and why are we doing it this way and how they can be involved at different levels? Can you give me an example?
Yeah. So really what we do as neonatal therapists is provide intervention early on, engage with the parents at bedside the moment that the infant is admitted to the NICU by introducing ourselves, introducing our role in developmental care. We talk to them about why we keep the lights low in the NICU, why we speak at, you know, lower volume in order to protect the infant's developing brain. Then we involve the nurses in that education as well, collaboratively. And the nurses will provide education to the parents on the next steps of progression and, you know, eventual discharge from the unit each step of the way, just by reinforcing everything the parent does as well positively through just saying, even if it's just simple touch, being like, they know that that's you touching them. Look at how they're responding. They don't respond to us that way because they know that it's you. And even if we have to provide along the line of, and within the plan of care, even if we have to provide, you know, corrective feedback in when they're feeding or in how they're holding their infant, we do so very gently. I like to just gently hand over hand manipulate, maybe position the baby in a more sideline position if we're working on feeding, or if the baby needs to be swaddled a little tighter, I just say, oh, let's swaddle a little tighter. That looks great. I love the way that you have done that. You did that like you already knew how to do it before I even told you. I can tell this comes really naturally to you, and they're responding so well to what you're doing. And so just giving positive reinforcement along with the simplified why of what we're doing makes them at the center of our, mm-hmm. our practice and makes them feel like they're a part of it from day one.
That's excellent. Thank you, Rebecca. Yeah.
No problem. And that's part of what you have to be able to understand as a speech language pathologist before starting in the NICU, you have to understand how to engage parents in the infant's care from day one. You don't want to have a mindset of just going in, doing your thing and, you know, piecing out. And other knowledge and skills that Asha would want for speech language pathologists to be able to demonstrate in order to work in the NICU would include foundations of developmentally supportive care. So synaptive theory of development, I'm going to talk about that a little bit in a minute. Staffing patterns, medical complications, just abnormal NICU presentations that can occur. Why do babies come into the NICU? What kind of equipment may they require? You know, at certain, you also need to know kind of when they develop their vision and hearing, and when can they tolerate, you know, touch, and just being able to read the infant's cues, because infants are very smart and they communicate with you from day one. And Dr. Heidi Alls, and I hope I'm saying that right, she realized that, and she dedicated her entire life to observing infant behaviors in the NICU to try and teach others what infants are trying to tell us since they're not able to verbally communicate. And she actually developed this synaptive theory of development, which is something that Asha and Nant recommends that speech language pathologists understand prior to working in the NICU. And that theory just states that infants have several physiological subsystems, including motor, autonomic, which would be autonomic is like your heart rate and your respiratory rate, state, so alert, drowsy, active alert, crying, attention, so are they able to engage in whatever it is that you're doing with them, and then self-regulatory. So any kind of negative experience within any kind of a negative experience can adversely affect these subsystems, and that adverse effect can cause the infant to react negatively repeatedly, and then that can map a certain experience into their brain and affect all of their experiences later. So that's why they kind of realized that infants who repeatedly had negative oral experiences, like maybe they had endotracheal intubation over and over. Maybe they, you know, had an oral gastric tube placed a bunch, and, you know, they're gagging and they're pushing away and all of those things. They realize that just the repeated exposure to that negative event could, you know, negatively affect their feeding development later, even as they grow into children. And so them realizing that kind of helped neonatal therapists and nurses and just all the medical team approach infant feeding differently from how they did historically. And so this is setting the stage for, you know, kind of why there's a lot of different opinions on infant feeding and why some of those relationships can be difficult to navigate between therapy and the medical team. A lot of the medical team has probably practiced in a time where infant feeding was mainly something called volume-driven. And volume-driven feeding culture supports getting all of the feed into the infant, no matter the cost. Feeding practices of the infant when you're operating under volume-driven is going to look like I'm unswaddling this infant to wake them up, because those physiological systems, if the infant is overwhelmed, the infant is going to disengage in the act of feeding. So kind of get away, be like, I'm kind of done feeding, I'm tired. And so the infant may start to try to fall asleep. Well, volume-driven approach is going to say, well, just take the unwrap that infant and wake that baby up to get that feed in them. And so just repeatedly, you know, unswaddling the infant, which we do swaddle the infant during the feeding, actually can cause like atypical motor development patterns, because they're like flailing about or they're like, you know, flaccidly hanging out there. And so also when you're doing volume driven feeding methods, you're going to be like shoving the nipple in the baby's mouth, you know, causing the baby to choke. Maybe the baby's holding their breath and you're ignoring that. Babies often hold their breath when they're being fed if they have too much in their mouth to communicate to the feeder that they're feeling overwhelmed, that something's not right, and that they need a break, they need to stop, so they may hold their breath, and that will affect their autonomic physiological subsystem that Dr. Alls talked about. So volume-driven feeding patterns would look like ignoring that. They realize that that feeding method can develop aversions to feeding later. And so collectively, the neonatal community decided to move away from just trying to get the infant to get down all of the bottle every time so that they could get them out of the door. And they moved away from volume-driven culture into something called infant-driven feeding culture. And Catherine Shaker has written a lot of papers on cue-based feeding. One of my favorite papers by her was in 2013, cue-based feeding. She talks about dynamic systems model, which is a lot like the synactive theory of development. And she talks about volume-driven culture and how what those behaviors associated with volume-driven culture look like and how it negatively affects infant feeding development. And then she talks about something called cue-based feeding, which is, you know, feeding the infant when they're showing signs of interest and then stopping the feeding when they are communicating to you that they're finished. And infant-driven feeding, to me, is a lot like cue-based feeding, except for there's a specific algorithm associated with infant-driven feeding. And this was developed by Sue Ludwig and Kara Ann Waitzman. And it's rooted in neurodevelopment and neuroprotection. And essentially, the infant drives the entire feeding, hence the name infant-driven. You will offer the bottle to the infant if the infant is communicating that they want to eat. And some of those signs of communication may be opening the mouth to accept the nipple, being quiet alert, so alert, engaged, bringing the hands to mouth, biting down, you know, sucking on the hands, rooting around. And in that moment, that would be communicating to you, the feeder, that the infant wanted to eat. So you would offer the infant the bottle. And you would also rate the infant's feeding readiness on a scale of like 1 to 5. And our NICU nurses rate our infants on the scale when they're on infant-driven feeding plan, but we also contribute to that rating system as well. 1 being the infant was super ready to eat, and then like it goes all the way to 5, which is 5, you would not feed the infant because they're like having heart rate changes. They're having drops in their oxygen. They're indicating to you, the feeder, that they don't want to eat, right? So a
distressed infant?
Yes, so a distressed infant. So Sue Ludwig and Kara Ann Waitzman, they just wanted to develop like a feeding approach that would quantify infants' feeding readiness and quantify their performance during the feeding, while attending to like those behaviors that the infant exhibits to tell you that they, you know, want or don't want to eat. So they wanted to account for that and really put neuroprotection and neurodevelopment at the center of the feeding practice. And so you would rate the infant's readiness on a scale. You would feed the infant, and at the completion of the feed, you rate them on their performance. You know, did they require a lot of pacing? Did they show you that they were overwhelmed by the feed, start to hold their breath and, you know, drop their oxygen? That would be, you know, a 5. And at those moments, you know, they support terminating the feeding. So if the infant, even if the infant doesn't, like, let's say the infant doesn't have a drop in their oxygen, but they disengage, they fall asleep, they support not finishing the feeding, and whatever the infant didn't eat will be run through the feeding tube in the nose. That's like the temporary feeding tube that just gives them supplemental nutrition while they're learning to develop their feeding skills. And then, you know, like I said, they rate on the scale early, like at the start, and then they rate at the completion. And they have a lot of data that supports this feeding method results in quicker discharge from the hospital than the volume-driven culture. And then it also results in less hospital readmissions because you're really moving at the infant's pace. So there's still not buy-in from everyone though, which is going to lead us into our discussion. But what were you going to say?
I love it that those were the two things that you mentioned that the research shows about that process, about how it leads to shorter time in the hospital and fewer readmissions. Those are two really important things to hospitals. And that's like how you sell admin and the higher ups on a program or a process, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, you can see that it works well for the patient, but it has to go beyond that. It has to mean something, I think, like to the system. And it's that like shorter length of stay, which is also is another indicator, like that the infant is accepting the food and thriving, and then fewer readmissions. They're not having other problems, but that's how hospitals measure things and how insurances measure things for hospitals too. I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and that is what, you know, caused our hospital system to purchase the program, because you have to train your staff on this. And they actually have like a full like CEU course that you take along with like competencies. And we have like our own policy. So it's not just something you can just be like, we're just going to do this today. Like you have to have like train all of your staff on it and what it means. And there's still not buy-in though from everyone on this, I think, because there's a lot of different reasons. I think that there's holding on to that aspect of volume driven that a lot of providers enjoy. And that is control, in all honesty. Like they like doctors and medical team. They like to feel like to an extent they're in control of the feeding plan and the plan of care. And it's normal to feel that way because you feel like you know best and you know best for your patient. And, you know, you feel like maybe even with infant driven that the infant is being offered the bottle too often, because maybe not every provider is reading the infant's cues in the way that you would read their cues because the training hasn't been perfected or something like that. And so there's an element of wanting to be able to control and contribute to that feeding plan and just being nervous about letting the infant guide it entirely, because there's that innate feeling that you as a provider know best. And I mean, that occurs even in our adult patients. You know, I mean, we want to control what we do with our adult patients, and we don't want to always let them have the autonomy that they deserve. And our infants have that autonomy too. And I think it's just like, it's interesting to think of them as little people, but they are, and they're in control of their feeding care plan. And I think that not wanting to do infant driven is related to not wanting to let them control that in a way. So
mm-hmm. I have a quick little question for you. As you've been giving examples and talking about things, you've mentioned a lot of talk about bottle. Do you do any breastfeeding in the NICU?
So we do breastfeeding in the NICU. I am not a lactation counselor. That is something I'm going to pursue soon. We have lactation consultants who come and work with our parents in the NICU. I have very few parents who just do like breast with our micro preemie and preemie infants because of transportation issues and not being able to be there at every touch time to offer the infant the breast. A lot of my parents have other children, but they can still be considered exclusively breastfed if they are pumping and providing the infant milk through the bottle. They still can consider that infant to be an exclusively breastfed infant, even if they're being offered the bottle sometimes. But yes, we do support breastfeeding in our NICU. I think like a lot of other NICUs, it's something that we need to work on to do more of, to provide our parents with more opportunities to attempt to breastfeed. But yes, and that the infant driven feeding program has its own kind of subset of protocol for breastfeeding. They often support offering the breast before you ever offer the bottle for our parents who do want to breastfeed. And maybe they want a breast and bottle, but they support offering the breast first and even earlier than offering the bottle. They also have an algorithm for knowing exactly how much to put in the infant's like tube, you know, if the infant was on the breast for a certain amount of time and then they fatigue just like they would with the bottle. Well, this is how much you would run through their tube in order to give them supplemental nutrition. So yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answered your question.
Okay, got it.
I hope that it did.
Absolutely. It did. Yeah. Like, I like how you pointed out how like it is available. It is an option, but the mom's not always able to be there 24/7 when the infant might be amenable to feeding.
Yeah.
You know, so she has other responsibilities. She won't be able to be there every time to offer that.
And that's tricky to navigate too. Like navigating that issue can create just friction between staff as well, because there are some staff who just feel like it's not an appropriate option for preemie infants, but we know that not to be true. You know what I mean? If there's a specialist working with them, if lactation's on board, if you have a dedicated parent, you know, but there's staff who thinks that it'll keep the baby from going home early. Like if they're allowed to breastfeed more. And I mean, so that's presenting evidence that refutes that can be really challenging. Also, navigating I keep going back to that because that's like what we're talking about, but like it can be complex to like navigate that with the parent, because if the parent chooses not to breastfeed anymore, they often have like a lot of shame associated with that. And so you have to come at them from a place of supporting them to breastfeed if that's what they want to do, and then giving them, you know, the evidence and research of why it's a great idea. But then also, like, if you can tell that they don't want to, or they just feel like they can't, like being, you know, reassuring them that that's okay. You know what I mean? And because there's just a lot of like shame associated with not being able to do that or choosing not to do that. So, and then there's people who say it can't happen. And so it's just, it's like a messy thing, and you just have to be, you know, honest, direct, but then also just completely kind and all the interactions that you have associated with that issue and every issue in the NICU.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm just seeing like minefields everywhere. I feel like you really need to have strong diplomatic skills to gain competencies in the NICU, because you're navigating a lot of really sensitive areas with parents, with other staff in the NICU. So, all right.
Yeah. It really is a challenge, because feeding the baby and the baby being able to eat and attain volumes is what is necessary for the baby to be able to go home. Now, you have to be able to support, you know, the nursing, the neonatologist, the dietitian, the case manager, all of them. You have to be able to recognize that their desire for the infant to be able to do that is completely valid, but balance, you know, the infant's communication and their, you know, respiratory needs and the neuroprotection as well. And that balance, it can be tricky. And honestly, it's really, really difficult for a young clinician to come into an environment like that where everyone has an opinion on how the infant should be fed, and the opinions are not always the same. That doesn't mean, sometimes there's more than one right opinion, and sometimes there isn't. I mean, there's sometimes where people are just wrong, and, you know, it's just really hard to have those conversations, because you always want to have to keep in the back of your mind that those providers are doing what is best for the infant in their mind. You know what I mean? Like, even if it's not necessarily what is best supported by evidence or what you as a neonatal therapist would consider best practice, in their mind, they are saying and doing what they think is right. They are not being malicious. They're not trying to undermine you. It's not personal. They don't hate you and think neonatal therapy is stupid. Like, they just don't, either they don't know, or they just have these deep-rooted opinions from prior experiences. And you have to be respectful of that, and be respectful of what it took for them to get into that unit that you're in. Because, you know, as a neonatal therapist, as a speech language pathologist practicing in the NICU, I mean, I still have tons of room to grow, but I am like so not who I was when I first started. And I had to do a lot to get to this point of confidence to be able to even speak on this topic to an extent. And I know that there's still so many more people that could speak to it even better than me. But like, I feel proud of where I'm at and I want them to respect me for what I've done. But in order for that respect to happen, like, you have to give that respect to them. I mean, it's a lot of nurses want to work in the NICU, and there they are, you know, working, and they do amazing things to save the lives of 22, 23 week old infants. And I mean, it's crazy. Like, they take them when they're like a pound or less than a pound, and they just grow them. And I mean, you have to be able to respect them for that and truly compliment them on their opinions and their work and get to know them as people. And when that happens, that respect just develops. You know what I mean? I think that in the first place that I worked, I did not even take the time to get to know the staff. Like, I just went in with my, you know, guns blazing, not real guns, because that's like sketchy, like not real guns, but like, I like went in just like neuroprotection and like everything y'all do that isn't on this list of developmentally supportive care is wrong. And, you know, let me point out everything that you're doing that I don't like. But, and I mean, no one wants to be told that what they've been doing for years is not correct. And no one wants to be just criticized without also being given positive reinforcement, just like we give positive reinforcement to those parents when we're giving them corrective feedback on positioning or feeding. We want to do the same thing to our NICU staff. One of the best things that, I mean, I did a lot of things wrong. Don't get me wrong. I had a nurse tell me like that I was like, you know, not confident to work down there, like that I wasn't competent to be down there. And that was a horribly sad situation and really hurtful. But it kind of like years later, I reflected and was like, well, I wasn't completely competent or confident. And so I don't blame her for saying that. I kind of wish we could have had like a side conversation about it because it was in front of a lot of people. But still, like, I mean, she wasn't completely wrong. But like, one of the good things that I felt like I had done with nursing staff where I work now is identify maybe those who've had rocky relationships with therapy in the past and go to them and say, you know, I really respect your opinion on this. I've been working with this infant and noticing these things. What are you noticing when you feed? Because we feed throughout the day, or, you know, there are some NICUs where they have like a night shift rotation for speech pathologists as well. So, you know, there may be some that are feeding at night too. But I mean, chances are we're not there every touch time for the infant. We're not, and the touch time is like the time where the infant gets fed either by the tube in their nose or by mouth. So we're not there every time the infant eats, right? But the nurses are. They are there. Even when we're there, they're there with us. And just, you know, showing them that respect that they also know what they're doing is just, it goes a long way. And I mean, it seems like so silly and so obvious, but, you know, I think that when therapy came on the scene in the NICU, it was way after the nurses had been in there, obviously. And so we came in with our different ideas and culture changing, you know, beliefs. And I think that we didn't necessarily do enough to show respect on the front end to like keep those positive relationships going. I'm not saying everyone didn't do that, but I know that I didn't do that when I started. And I know just anecdotally some other therapists who've said that they've made similar mistakes as well.
So I think what I'm hearing is like there is an established protocol or way of doing things and like an established community on the NICU. The NICU is very, what's the word I'm looking for? Like not exclusive or inclusive, but like almost sheltered. It's like a little enclave within the hospital, right?
Mm-hmm. It is.
And then we come on the scene, we're outsiders coming in. And so I can see where it would rub people very much the wrong way to start throwing around these ideas that like how they've been practicing in this tight-knit community might not be what's best for the infant when their whole career is dedicated to what's best for the infant and supporting this young and fragile life. So I can see where that there's a whole lot of things going on there and where the primary focus when you're starting on a unit would be that relationship building, getting to know the staff and having them get to know you. Because without that trust in each other with any of the staff on there, then like, how does anything get accomplished without that?
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's a culture, honestly, and they're very protective, and it is a unit unlike no other. And being a part of it when you all have a beautiful working relationship is one of the most rewarding settings you can ever work in, hands down. If you do not have that relationship with the staff, it can be the hardest and one of the most unpleasant settings to work in. And so it makes or breaks your experience, and it makes or breaks, honestly, the ability to provide neuroprotective and just evidence-based care to the infant. So a lot of it is learning your staff members, getting to know them, showing them you care, and then also just figuring out like what works best with who to get to the best outcomes for the infant. Like I have my neonatologists are not the same at all. Like if I feel like I need something accomplished with one, I might go about it in a different way than I will with the other. But we still reach the
your approach.
Yes.
Your like how you approach that neonatologist is different just because what works for one person doesn't work for the other person, even though like your outcomes or your goal would be the same.
Yes. Yes. Because everybody, and it just makes sense. Like even when, if you take like leadership development training or any kind of training on communication, they always like emphasize, like know who you're communicating with and adjust to that person's style accordingly in order to get, you know, the best outcome of the conversation. So I've done a lot of reading on that, and I think it's really interesting. But it does make sense because I think that I'm a really direct communicator for the South, I'd like to add, because I've had people from the North tell me that I'm like very like small talky and like very just pleasant. But people from around here think that I am really abrasive and direct. So I guess it just depends on where you're at in the country. To get to know me, but around here, I'm a little abrasive and direct, and not everybody likes it. And so the older I get, the more I have to adjust. But I started, my first adjustments I made in my communication style were in this unit to match like what I felt like the other person, where they were at and what they desired in a conversation. And I mean, I'm telling you now, like some of the relationships and the people in the NICU, it truly brings tears to my eyes just to know how much I love them and how much they love what they do and how much, you know, even if they may be a little resistant to something new, if you just get their buy-in that it's what's best, I mean, they're going to go all in for it because they want to do what's best. And so, and a lot of units, I'm not saying like every unit's perfect and that every nurse has that mindset, but I think a lot of them do. And I think that we as therapists, you know, just think that there are some units that just don't like therapy, but maybe we haven't done the legwork on our end to improve those relationships. So
I feel like kind of the key takeaway, like what we've built the foundation on and tried to establish, is there can be differing opinions on the unit about how to feed the infant, where everyone's coming from the same place about like protecting, doing the neuroprotection for the infant and what's best for the infant, but like approaches may differ based on experiences and length of time practicing and exposure to different information. And so as SLPs join the therapy team in the NICU, like what we need to understand is we need to integrate with the team, and we have to get on board with the team first before we can really feel like we can, I don't want to say challenge any ideas, but maybe like get people to consider alternatives for practice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Whereas I'm a lot like you, Rebecca. I'll just be like, why are you doing that?
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's good.
That's so what not to do.
Well, and then when you get to a point where you're communicating really well with your staff and they have accepted practice patterns, and a lot of, I want to say that I came into this unit and the therapist that was working in the unit before me had really set up a lot of awesome things. Like she had really just got a lot of great education in there. And there were a lot of nurses who were very progressive on the forefront of new information. And so they had already accepted a lot of current evidence as best practice. So I feel really fortunate for that. I would like to say that. But even as your relationships with staff grow, little things that you tell them, now I'll go in and they'll be like, I heard this happened the other night, like not telling on each other, but just like trying to like make me aware of like any kind of like gentle conversation that needs to be had, or, you know, maybe you could let so-and-so know about this or something, you know, I mean, and they want what's best. And it just really feels like we're all on the same team. And that kind of it can happen in other places. I'm not saying like it can't happen in your adult units. It can't happen. It can, but it's just so special when it comes together in the NICU like that. That doesn't mean that they do, you know, everything that I want all the time, because that's not realistic, but just giving you a place at the table because you've shown that you care about them as people and not just, you know, you just want to steamroll them and be like, why are you doing that? It just really is. It's a rewarding unlike nothing else. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool. Excellent. I really enjoyed this conversation. I learned a ton. I love all your examples. And I really enjoyed learning about the theories, like that foundational knowledge about like why we want to listen to the infant and how we listen to the infant, how they communicate with us about what's working, what's not working, how they're ready, when they're ready, and when they're not, and when they're finished with feeds. So I love that. And of course, I love a system of measuring that. Like, I think that's so interesting that they created that and developed it. So there's something consistent to show you any type of changes over time or improvements, or if something starts to go a little downhill, like you're aware and you monitor it and you check for bigger issues that might be an indication of. So I think that's really great. I had one last question for you.
Okay.
Okay. So speaking about that scale, about like you're gauging the infant's interest in a feed, and then after you feed them, you report on their performance, their feeding performance. Have you ever had an infant that was interested in the feed and then you go to do it, but they have a poor performance?
Yes.
And what does that tell you?
So it could tell me so many different things. It really kind of depends on how old the infant is. A lot of our infants that are just starting to feed are like that. They'll be really interested right off, but they just can't regulate themselves during the feeding. They just can't get it under control. And that tells me that even though they're demonstrating signs of readiness, maybe their respiratory system is just too compromised at this point for us to do anything more than just pacifier dips, where I take a little milk and dip it on the pacifier and let them suck. Sometimes if it's pretty severe, if their reaction is pretty severe to the feeding and it happens really early on, and I, you know, I try different strategies to keep it from happening in terms of like their severe disengagement or their drops in their oxygen or heart rate. Like if I do everything I can to keep it from happening and the infant disengaging and the infant's dropping their respiratory status, and it still occurs, and it might just tell me that they're not ready, even though they think they are, and that we just need to be even more extra careful with them and, you know, reward their hunger cues with taste, but maybe not with the bottle or breast quite yet. And so honestly, if I have an infant that's really, really interested, most of the time I can do like a modified positioning. I can like pace them more during the feed just by tipping the bottle down to remind them to breathe, or I can give them an even slower flowing nipple and it will remedy some of their behaviors that show that they're overwhelmed that happens during the feeding. So most of the time, like you can give them things to help them do better. But sometimes if you do all those things and they still are dropping their oxygen, they still are, you know, getting really freaked out, then it just tells you that they're not quite ready.
I find this area of our practice excessively dynamic. like you're monitoring and assessing like at every step of the way and making adjustments as they communicate to you with their body language, with their cues and everything. And you're like, okay, let's try this. Did that fix that? Did that help? Did that improve this situation? Okay, now let's try that. Like you're constantly problem solving. Are you like exhausted at the end of a day if you work in the NICU? Is it just like brain melt?
I am exhausted, especially if I see them at multiple touch, because I will try to see them. Like one day I saw the same child like three times. It's not different. It's different from like acute care with your adult patients where you might just like, okay, I saw them for a cog eval and I'll see them for cognitive treatment tomorrow. It's like, I'm going to go back at this time because the parents are coming. And I'm going to go back at this time because we've adjusted their volume and I want to see if they can keep up because, you know, as they grow, they have to, you know, consume more. I want to see if they can keep up with that, or you know, I've never seen them at this time, so I want to know what their alertness looks like. And so I am really tired. I do feel, but at the same time, because it's like such a fun, like team and supportive team, and they are just genuinely glad when I'm there. It's like a, when I go in. So it's yes and no.
Yeah, I like that. It's a very engaging day.
It is.
That's awesome. High reward, but high work.
Yeah. And I think that the last part of really just navigating those relationships is pushing yourself to achieve those higher levels of competency. You don't have to be a certified neonatal therapist or a lactation counselor or an IBCLC to work in the NICU as a speech pathologist, but obtaining those higher level certifications will push the boundaries of your practice and show staff that you are serious about what you do. And that helps you get respect as well and helps you provide better care for your patients. So, I mean, well, the unit I work in now, my occupational therapist, she has so many awesome credentials. She's always constantly looking for ways to improve herself. And I'm just so proud of her. And I think that the team is as well. So
that's cool. Well, thank you, Rebecca. This was so informative. Like I've learned a ton and I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast. I had a blast recording with Rebecca. I love her insights to the importance of building rapport with the team on the NICU. And yes, like competence is huge. You could be the smartest person on the unit, but if you don't have buy-in and respect with the team, then I feel like you might kind of end up spinning your wheels. So I feel like that's important to know. All right, so don't forget to check out the show notes on speechuncensored.com for links to more resources and the discussion guide. A big thanks to Laura Miller for her amazing audio editing skills. And I'd be honored if you could post a thoughtful review on Apple Podcasts so other SLPs can find the podcast and join us on this journey. I'm so glad that you've decided to spend some of your time with the Speech Uncensored podcast. And I hope the material that we've covered has nourished your mind so that your practice can flourish. Now I hope that you get out there and be awesome.